Welcome to another podcast from Transforming Business Minds. I'm Alan Patching. And once again, I have with me Mr. John Thomas, well known internationally for his economic advice and well known because of the people he gives it to, including the US President Obama and many of the leaders of other countries around the world. Most of you have been following his series for a while, so we'll get straight into having a chat with John.
What I deal with is Warren Buffett, who I've known for about 30 years. I used to do business with him at Morgan Stanley, and he has been a regular reader of my letter since it started. He was one of the original principal investors in the service. And a few years ago, he bought 5% of the Bank of America, largest bank in the United States, and he told the media that he got the idea for buying Bank of America when he was sitting in the bathtub reading research. And what annoyed me is that he didn't tell people that he was reading my research because we had put out an alert to buy Bank of America the previous day. We told people to buy Bank of America call options. And although I never got the credit for the original suggestion to Buffett, my readers did get a 400% profit in one weekend. And so that sort of goes down into the
Credit, but your bank account did.
You know, lore of the period.
Have you met Buffett since and had a crack at him about that?
Yeah, you know, I see him about once a year. I get invited to the shareholder meetings because I'm a shareholder in my pension fund. And he's asked me to speak at some of his events, but I tend not to speak at other people's events.
Yeah.
I've got plenty of my own to keep my hands busy with. And I know some of his board members, so and he has a house in California, so we
catch up occasionally.
We catch up occasionally. Obviously, he's in demand. I only talk to him when I have something important to say, so that's not very often.
He's one of those. I think a lot of people would disagree with that, John. He's one of those people that, when it comes to property, used to say, "Don't sell anything." Does he still take that view?
It's true. You know, he says your best tax strategy is to never sell, and therefore the taxes are never due. And then when you die, your wife gets to step up in the cost basis, and she never pays taxes. So,
mind you, I should say this is American taxes.
He has done that in his own personal life. His core shareholdings he's owned since the 1950s. He owned IBM and Hewlett-Packard and, you know, a lot of these great companies. From very early days on, General Electric is another one. Pepsi is one of his favorites. He still has them. And in the United States tax law, if you don't sell, there's no profit.
Yeah.
No profit, no tax.
Yeah.
And plus, you get the compounding over time.
And that it's from what we were saying before, the compounding factor, you just can't forget. It is the most powerful way of getting rich.
And he calls that the snowball effect.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the latest biographies on him is called Snowball. It's outstanding reading, by the way, for the beginning investor. And, if you just allow the compounding effect to kick in, which is capital gains plus dividends, over 10, 20, 30 years, a few dollars turns into a few $100,000.
Wait a couple of years and it goes exponential.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned before the Clintons being friends of yours.
Mm-hmm.
Do you operate with them, your acquaintance with them? Is that more a personal or more a business thing?
Well, we don't do business. You know, I provide assistance to the United States government whenever it's requested. I'm a soldier. I follow orders. Well, when I get a request for help, I do it, and I do it for free. I've never accepted a dollar from the government. And that takes me back to Bill Clinton when he was president. I was doing some intelligence work for the U.S. military and was called up to the White House for a thank you and a handshake. And, I've been in touch with him on and off ever since. I saw him just a few months ago. When he was coming through town to raise money for his nonprofit, which has turned into a massive global enterprise now. He's raised something like $250 million for emerging country development, disease prevention, and that sort of thing.
It's interesting that these great politicians of the time become even greater statesmen after their term in leadership.
There's one common factor that I've noticed in all world leaders, and this starts with Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, all the way up to the Clintons, all the way up to President Obama. All these people have one thing in common. They are world-class networkers. Mm. They can network. They connect with people like no one else can. And you're when you're in the presence of an Obama or a Bill Clinton, they have a magnetism which is unbelievable, which you can only really capture when you see them in person. Clinton knows or knew the name of every precinct worker, you know, every political boss in the United States. There had to be thousands of them. He knew them all by first name. He knew their wife's name. He knew their golf score. He was just their best friend for life. And that's how you win presidential elections, is building these massive networks where people just contribute millions and millions of dollars to get you to win.
Now, you've met him. There's a theory going around that Clinton's the sort of person that when you're with him, even though you're one of 100 people in the room, while he's talking to you, you're the only person in the room.
It's absolutely true.
Is that true?
Because when you talk to him, he looks you straight in the eye, he gives you a firm handshake, and all of a sudden, for your 5 seconds, you're the most important person in the world. And I've actually seen that with many politicians.
It's a real art and a skill, isn't it?
By the way, Margaret Thatcher did not have that. She did not empathize with people she met. She kind of viewed every person coming at her as a threat. But then I only met her after she'd been prime minister for a few years. And, you know, the assault that she had to endure from the left is somewhat similar to what Obama is getting now from the right.
You know?
And that kind of makes you a hardened person over time.
And that's the title, The Iron Lady. But behind that, I think...
Very well deserved.
Yeah.
By the way, she was the Iron Lady even before she became Prime Minister.
Right.
I met her when she was just elected. I was working for The Economist then, and she came out to Tokyo for a summit, and the other British press warned me. I said, watch out for this Margaret Thatcher. She'll rip you to pieces if she doesn't like your question. Sure enough, she ripped me to pieces.
A little joke here for the listeners. I was working with Sir David Longhi, deceased now, former New Zealand Prime Minister, and he tells a story from the stage, which he swears is true, that he travelled with Thatcher once and they were running late and decided they better stop for dinner somewhere with their entourage.
Mm-hmm.
And Margaret Thatcher's hint at humour was when they squeezed them into the back of a restaurant that was about to close, and people said, we have to order very quickly. What will you have, Madam Prime Minister? And she said, I'll have steak, please, medium. And he said, and what about the vegetables? And she said, they'll have the same. I'm not sure whether it's true or long he was pulling my leg, but it's a darn good story.
I'd be more on the fiction side.
I think so. Even though it was
she didn't have that kind of sense of humor.
No, a bit dry. Okay, let's move on a little bit. We've talked about the Clintons and Thatcher, and I think people are interested in this. You met Obama, obviously. You're an advisor to his administration. He's a man doing it tough, as was Julia Gillard, our last prime minister, or last term first female prime minister. And she never really had the chance to show her wares because of the numbers game. Obama's got a bit of that as well. He's the president, but he doesn't have Congress behind him.
Well, he had it for 2 years and then lost it in the backlash that followed 2 years later.
So what's your view on him as a leader? How do you see his future? Well, obviously he's going to resign.
You know, his future is one of a entertaining retirement.
Yeah.
He only has 3 years left as president. You're not allowed to run a third time except in a national crisis. So... he is extremely intelligent, extremely engaging, incredibly fast learner, but his grounding is as a social worker, as a community organizer. That's where his passion is.
You think that came, that was behind Obamacare, that background?
That's just one piece of the puzzle. Hmm. Obamacare, national health care, has been a Democratic objective for 60 years.
A long time, of course, yeah.
Truman actually was the first to propose national health care, and it was shot down as a communist conspiracy because at the time we had the McCarthy hearings going on. There was a big anti-communist wave of fear going on. You know, the Soviet Union just got the atomic bomb, had spy trials and all that stuff going on. So not a good time to bring out a national health care program.
Exactly.
But there were many attempts since then. One of the most recent ones was under President Nixon.
Hmm.
Then we had Hillary care after that. So this is the end of a 60-year effort. But no, his passion is community organizing, helping poor people, helping minorities. That is really where he really wants to make change.
That's his legacy that he wants to achieve.
You know, that, among other things. But this is the one that he actually believes in strongly. Talk to him about financial matters, about the military. He's attentive, he's interested, he pays attention, but you can't believe that this is something he's absolutely passionate about. Okay.
And, is that a worry
and
for
people,
a president of the
people,
free world?
No, it's not. People interpret this as weak leadership. It's not. Some things are just better left alone. I mean, the private sector is doing great right now. They don't need any leadership. They're doing fine without a leader. Thank you very much.
The government never had a lot of contribution to helping private enterprise.
You know, in the military issues, he steps in when he needs to. You know, the big concern was that if we ever got Osama bin Laden cornered, that he would put him on trial, that he would try to negotiate with him. Something, you know, make a video, who knows. But when push came to shove, he said, shoot. You know, which was the right thing to do at the time.
So when the big decisions are there, he's capable of making
and he made the right decision. I advised him to go into Syria militarily, you know, do a standoff, air attack, take out the entire Syrian military establishment, which would have taken maybe 2 days. And he said no.
But don't
he
do
held
that.
Off for talks. And he got the talks, but then the talks then gave an entree to Russia into the international political scene. So it hasn't really worked. The problem with Syria is such a complicated situation. Our natural ally in that whole civil war is al-Qaeda. So do you want to be allied with al-Qaeda in one country and fighting them in the country next door?
Sure.
There's no way you could have supplied weapons to Syria without them falling into the hands of al-Qaeda. And they were asking for, you know, anti-air missiles, handheld anti-air missiles, like they had in Afghanistan. Well, give al-Qaeda an anti-air missile, get you a life prison sentence right now in the U.S.
I'm interested, intrigued, actually, at the thought that you recommended. I can see the reasons you might, from a Syria-only perspective, both having military backgrounds. But did you not consider the Iran potential to get involved?
I did exactly consider that. And, you know, as a hedge fund trader, I'm all about asymmetric returns. I like to bet a dollar to make, you know, $10 but only risk 25 cents. Intervention in Syria gave you an asymmetric return, because what that would have done, if you had caused the regime fall in Syria, that would have left Iran totally isolated. Okay, and would have pushed them to the negotiating table sooner.
Presuming Russia didn't
get over their nukes. Okay, now our action in Syria, for what it was, may have been a factor in pushing Iran to the negotiating table. Anyway, he may have had access to intelligence I don't have that pushed him in that direction. Who knows? We'll find out in 10 years when the book comes out. Iran is now negotiating with us about closing down their nuclear program. That's the most important issue
positive
right now.
Positive thing, absolutely.
I was brought in on this one because I'm a biochemist. I know about poison gases. I was asked to look at the evidence to see if there was poison gas. You know, from what I could calculate, it had been used at least 7 times, if not more. We had recordings of telephone calls ordering chemical weapon strikes. I mean, that's how clear-cut it was. So certainly, you know, if chemical weapons were your concern, the rationale for going into Syria was there 100%. If broader geopolitical regional considerations are at hand, he has the intelligence, not me.
Absolutely.
He made his call. So,
and rightly so. Now, let's move a little broader. You've been to 4 inaugurations of U.S. presidents. You've known 8 or 9 of them. Who is the most interesting from your perspective? Let's leave economic talk out of it. Who's the most interesting and why? You mentioned Reagan once or twice when we were chatting before.
You know, Reagan was an interesting person, but he always pissed me off because he was always deceiving people in one way or another. And I didn't really learn the extent of this until a few years ago, when I got to know his Treasury and Secretary of State pretty well. And then I learned what his true motives were. Reagan's goal in life was total nuclear disarmament. He wanted to return the world to the 1930s pre-nuclear. go back into a world where everyone was safe and no one could get destroyed overnight in an accidental Armageddon. And everything he did during his administration worked towards that goal.
He must have had a lot of opposition to that.
He did, especially from the U.S. military.
Exactly.
But he got pretty far. You know, we reduced our number of nuclear weapons under Reagan from 10,000 to about 3,000 where they are now. And the Russians dropped theirs even more. So they made progress on that. But he never, ever mentioned in public that this was his goal. Mm. Not once.
Did he mention it in the government forum in private and secrecy, or just
his cabinet knew. Mm. His core cabinet secretaries, James Baker and George Shultz, absolutely knew what was going on.
Is there any record of their attitude to it?
Oh yeah, you can ask them today.
They hated the idea.
They'll tell you. And in fact, both men are still working behind the scenes on the nuclear front, on arms issues with Russia. And they've also made several proposals on the Iran front.
Do they support him?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
really. A nice goal, and an unusual goal to have at a time when people were very conscious of the arms race and all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
of American making the first move is almost unheard of.
Reagan made a lot of mistakes. He was running two sets of books, for example. He was proposing budgets, claiming they would generate surpluses when, in fact, they knew that they would generate big deficits. David Stockman is now out in public.
And governments would never do that
today. out in public on this issue, so it's pretty well documented.
Yeah.
But, as a person, as a human being, as an individual, boy, you just couldn't beat a handshake from Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Always had a joke. Usually you had a dirty joke.
Yeah.
all those times, we sat at these press conferences, he's when the cameras are off, he's out there telling blue jokes left, right, and center. And I'll tell you one of those jokes now because I remember it. They used to say that it was really a good thing that he got out of politics when he did, because got out of show business when he did, because if he was still in show business, he'd have to take his clothes off, and he didn't think that would sell with the ladies very well.
Oh, well.
He came up with far worse. That's one I can repeat on the air.
In polite company. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Moving further afield than the United States, we know you work with generals in the United States and advise senior military personnel as well. You mentioned in the presentation you did today that one of your biggest clients is the CIA. That intrigued me. What's behind that?
Well, the CIA is the world's greatest research organization. They have experts on everywhere and every place. They have language experts on languages you've never heard of. It all goes into a massive database. Their budget is top secret, but it's $70 billion, in case you were wondering. It's probably larger than that now. And they get the cream of American university graduates every year, and people then stay for life. You don't meet a lot of ex-CIA officials.
Except dead ones.
Well, even then. People tend to stay in the business for life.
I meant that seriously, that if they're doing their job in some strange country, they can come to a grisly end.
Even then, you never find out if they work for the CIA.
Oh, right.
Because you then don't want their contacts to become a target.
Yeah, sure.
So, great bunch of people, and I just so happen to cover a very broad range of subjects.
Effectively, you do the research for them.
What I do is I do the out-of-the-box thinking for them, and I put the big pieces together for the long term. Because anybody inside any big institution, that is the problem, is thinking out of the box, coming up with something totally creative. You get establishment views inside the CIA. And then the really big black swans, they always tend to miss. No one in the CIA predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. The most important thing that could have been predicted in the last half century, they missed. Okay, nobody predicted the first and second oil crises. Okay, no one predicted 9/11. They tend to miss on the really big out-of-the-blue things.
Do they listen when you give them out of the box, or do you have to go higher, like to the president?
All I know is they pay for their subscriptions.
The consultants
and occasionally I'll get a call in the middle of the night asking if country A invaded country B, what would be the impact on commodity X and stock market C? That's what they can't do, is integrate, because they don't have market experience and they haven't been doing this for 40 years.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And then, of course, knowing the heads of the CIA, I've known most of them over the last 40 years. One of them got my wife out of jail once in Russia, William Colby.
I'm intrigued to find out how she got into jail in Russia.
She was a stewardess for British Airways and was on a Tokyo-Moscow flight. And she was walking out of her hotel room, and someone came up out of nowhere and threw a book manuscript at her. And it hit her and fell to the ground, and the second it hit the ground, a bunch of KGB agents piled on top of her. And it turns out that the book manuscript was written by a dissident who was trying to smuggle it out of the Soviet Union, and he was being followed. And he, of course, immediately got arrested. My wife got arrested. And then the KGB in Tokyo then contacted me and said, we have your wife. This is what happened. You know, and that's all I found out. So I went to the American Embassy. I was friends with the ambassador then. His name was Mike Mansfield, senator from Montana. You may have heard of the Mansfield Amendment, which brought the Vietnam War to an end. And I said, you know, this has happened. What can you do? And he says, well, it's unfortunate your wife is a foreign national, so officially we can't do anything about this. He then says, however, I may have a friend who can help you. And then in walks William Colby, you know, head of the CIA, ran the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and had been with the OSS in World War II, parachuting into France and all this. A legend in the intelligence community. It literally was like having James Bond walk out there and says, I can help you. So he said, well, what do they want? And he said, well, the KGB says that the CIA has just produced a report saying that Soviet oil production is going to collapse and go to zero within 10 years. They want a copy of the report. And I said, I don't have this report. What should I do? And he says, give it to him. I said, what? He said, give him the report. I said, I don't have one. He says, we'll give you a copy. I said, okay. So, got the report, gave it to the KGB. They let my wife out of jail the next day. She flew home, never ever took a Russian flight again.
Understandably.
And 10 years later, I discovered that the CIA report was totally false.
Structured because they wanted them to get
There was no forecasted collapse of Soviet oil production. The whole thing had been invented to scare Russia into doing more contracts with American oil companies.
Which happened. Yeah.
In the 80s, one of the first things that happened when Glasnost started and Gorbachev was prime minister, was they started doing deals with American oil companies to improve 50-year-old technology in the Caucasus, in Baku, where the oil was. And that all happened. So, you know, I was just a cog in this giant conspiracy to hoodwink the Soviet Union.
Though.
And I actually kept in touch with the KGB agent who contacted me, and after the fall of the Soviet Union, he went to work for a hedge fund, an American hedge fund, and 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, he called me out of the blue, and he says, buy wheat. I said, why buy wheat? He says, the entire Russian wheat crop for this year is on fire, and the government is about to ban all exports of wheat to prevent a famine in Russia. I said, oh, okay. Next day, trade alert, buy wheat. And people made a fortune on that one. We got a double in 2 months off the price of wheat.
Amazing. I'm intrigued. When the American friend said, give them the report, did it ever cross your mind that when you gave it to them, you might then be accused of what your wife was accused of over there, namely
of
spying?
He did a lot more than give me a report.
Right.
He basically gave me intelligence 101. You know, I spent hours with him telling me how I should behave. I'm a journalist, who I can talk to, who I can't do, what I should do. It was basically the golden rules of how to survive. And it's really kept me alive all these years. And it's also kept me dealing at an arm's length basis with the U.S. government.
Some powerful people. Yeah.
So that has been valuable. And whenever a new CIA chief comes into office, I usually meet him within the first couple of months.
All you need to do is change in your drink from red wine into a teeny shaken, not stirred, and you'll be the new James Bond.
Oh, but they give you such an awful hangover. I'd be a terrible James Bond.
Yeah, the accent's all wrong.
Not sure if I could handle. Yeah, all the bad guys in the world have British accents. So, at least according to the Academy Awards. So,
now you've interviewed Marcus. You've interviewed all these Thatcher we've already mentioned. Yasser Arafat. Who is the most interesting person you've ever interviewed, not so much from the financial side, but when you were doing the columns for The Economist and the Financial Times?
Boy, that is a really tough one, because it's been a lifetime of meeting interesting people. Interviewing my first terrorist, Yasser Arafat, I always had to wonder if I was going to get shot by his bodyguard. Looking from a totally alien viewpoint of how he sees the West, that was fascinating.
Did that filter your questions, the fear that they could be precipitous and get upset?
Well, it turned out I did almost get shot, so that's why I mentioned that. There have just been so many. President Carter is basically a living saint.
He comes across as that.
His concern for the average man, for global humanity, can't be measured. He, on the one hand, he'll say, yes, he approves of U.S. sanctions towards errant countries. On the other hand, he's involved with the charities, has to go in and take care of the starving children on a humanitarian basis. Mm. So, there's always two sides to every issue.
Hard question.
Yeah, I'd really have to think
probably
long and hard on that one
to
come up with more names.
Let's put it another way, reverse it. Who would be the person, if you can say this without getting shot, who would be the person that your life wouldn't have been any the worse for having not interviewed? One that you did interview, but you really couldn't have cared if you didn't, from the upper echelon?
There are some people who you occasionally really dislike. Coming up with a really specific name without getting in trouble,
probably an unfair question.
Tough to mention. I can tell you there are some hedge fund managers, people running $20, $30, $50 billion in capital, who certainly would meet that category.
Less than desirable.
But I won't
friends.
Mention that name, because they do have a propensity to sue.
Yeah, and with $30 or $50 million in capital, you can
unlimited
get good lawyers
to do whatever they damn want to.
Yeah. Now, you've met some fascinating people, and just talking to you gives us an insight into people that most listeners will never meet. I'd like to, just because we do have a lot of Middle East listeners, have you met any of the people in the Middle East in the leadership level? I understand you've met some of the Mactoon family.
Yeah, when I was at Morgan Stanley, I dealt with pretty much all of the royal families on the Persian Gulf. Mm. And in those days, we were soliciting funds from their national funds, like Abu Dhabi Investment Authority and so on.
Which is still a very powerful financial entity.
To invest in U.S. assets, and they did. They were a major customer of ours.
And still do.
And then after the first Gulf War, I was brought in as an expert to liquidate the Kuwait Investment Authority's holdings in global equities to pay for the war. Mm. That first war was entirely paid for by Kuwait, and guess what their largest holding was in? It was in Japanese stocks. Why? Because I'd sold it to them in the previous decade.
Yeah.
So I was involved in that. That was a very hush-hush deal. We didn't want the market to know what we were doing without crashing it.
It would have had a massive effect.
They owned 5% of the top 200 Japanese companies at the time. So that was a very big
The Japanese companies didn't need any help to get into trouble about that time.
Yeah, really, with an oil crisis on and all of that. So, I got to know them pretty well. of course, this was 30 years ago, and a lot has changed then. The boats have gotten a lot bigger. You know, you can see them all parked in Piraeus in Greece. And they've also gotten more sophisticated financially a lot over the last 30 years.
The Middle East.
Like 40 years ago, you were really dealing with men out of the desert. Most of the people in the country were still barefoot, and now they're all driving Range Rovers.
I think it's the most commonly misinterpreted or misperceived place on the planet. I'm talking particularly places like Oman, Dubai, Abu Dhabi particularly, even Saudi and these places. Most people think of it as a backward community with terrorists and all this.
Well, it's a classic example of how prejudices are always wrong.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just some of the most educated, highly intelligent thinking people with an amazing development record and have done so well. You know?
Their cultures are 5,000 years old. You know, we're not going to teach them anything. You know, we were living in log cabins when they were conquering Europe.
Absolutely.
We were living in caves when they were conquering Europe. So, you know, who are we to say who has the superior culture here or the superior history?
Absolutely. Now, one final question. You've done some interesting things outside of your business and professional life, like climb most of Mount Everest. You've gone for a ride to the edge of space in a MiG fighter. You go snow skiing, mountain climbing, and you have a very full and balanced life.
Mm-hmm.
What aspect of the things you do that are out there, like climbing Everest, like what's the best memory you had of the things you did that had nothing to do with business?
Well, going to the edge of space, that's got to rank up there. Being at 21,000 feet on Mount Everest, that's up there. Eating at Tour d'Argent in Paris for the first time is always a thrill.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be the best restaurant in the world. I just look all over the world, look at what the most fun and interesting things are to do, and then go do them. I create bucket lists, and then I do everything on the list, and then I make a new list. Right now I'm on my fourth bucket list, always looking for new thrills. Right now on the new list, we have climbing Kilimanjaro in Africa and running with the bulls at Pamplona.
Do Kilimanjaro first.
Yes. I don't run that fast anymore, and I don't look good in red.
Pick a day with the old bulls.
Yeah, Kilimanjaro would be easy. It's just a six-day slog and getting the weather right. The bulls, my family and friends aren't too thrilled about that one either.
The children are saying, don't do it, Dad, don't do it. Well, John, thanks very much for these moments and insights in a life that has to be.
Ensure you don't miss the opportunity to hear John's webinar coming up in the very near future. Register on the website www.transformingbusinessminds.com and we'll send you an email with details of when John's next webinar will be taking place.
Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks very much, John. We'll catch you again real soon.